Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
The All-Ireland Finals, well, they seem like a distant memory at this stage with a seasonal shift from September, which is still hard to get used to. But the club season would be hopping now right all around the country. And the GAA, as you know, it is the largest voluntary and community organisation on this island. Journalist Michael Moynihan has been looking at the forces shaping the sport and reshaping it and the movement in general. He joins us in studio. Has a look of Ernest Hemingway about him, I have to say. Good morning, Michael.
Thanks. We're starting with the easy stuff.
The hardest stuff of all, because you're a Cork man.
Yeah.
Have you recovered from the summer?
It's still very raw. It's still very raw, Oliver. Like, a lot of us are wandering the streets and weeping and sobbing. No, look, it was a terrible day, but sure, we'll move on. Best of luck to Tipperary. They were the best team on the day.
My people are from East Cork. I can't have conversations with them. Be gentle with them. I think they've gone for long walks in the rain.
I know. As Morrissey said, I can smile about it now, but at the time it was terrible.
They're smiling in West Waterford, I can tell you that. More Than a Game is the name of the book. A bit of a state of the nation, the GAA, isn't that what you're doing here?
Yeah, that's a fair description. As you say, the GAA is such an enormous organisation with tentacles in every parish, so I thought a pretty obvious approach would be to see, you know, okay, this is where the GAA is, but where is it going? I mean, we're very good for histories and retrospectives, but I just wanted to kind of poke the bear a little bit and see, you know, is the GAA on the right track, or is there even a right track? Put it that way.
You're dead right, because we're really good at doing all the anniversaries and looking back and the heroes and legends, and but don't look forward too often. Although there is a big movement forward, the amalgamation of ladies football, Camogie, that's all going to be a very positive experience in about 2 years' time.
Yes. If it happens in 2 years' time, I think that time frame is probably a little bit optimistic. There's a lot of moving parts. You're talking about, you know, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. There are a lot of local challenges, and there's a lot of, you know, significant kind of, not global challenges, but national challenges. I mean, recently we had a kind of bit of gunboat diplomacy with the head of the Camogie Association saying Charlotte Burns, figures of €500 million for integration were nonsense, which is not the kind of, we're all moving forward together happily.
Great camaraderie.
Yeah, the messaging not great, you would have to say.
It's a bit political.
Yeah.
Speaking of Cork, by the way, there is a chapter, Páirc Uí Chaoimh, or An End to Corkness. And
yes.
Like, even though we've read it before, it's truly shocking when you sum it up like that, just the absolute overruns and the death that's been left in Cork because of that stadium and the pitch that didn't work.
Yeah, it's funny that something like Páirc Uí Chaoimh, specifically the match between Cork and Limerick last year, a great game down in Páirc Uí Chaoimh, kind of ties a lot of the themes of the book together. That was a game that had to be shifted for a concert. The concert was necessary because of the overrun. The overrun happened because of renovations. So you've got a lot of the moving parts I touch on in the book. Elite sport, broadcasting, the finance behind stadia.
Because it had to be moved, then it fell out of free television.
And then we had the GAA Go controversy of blessed memory that I'm sure is as sensitive here as the All-Ireland Final defeat is in Cork. But yeah, the Páirc Uí Chaoimh is really a cautionary tale for every unit, obviously, of the GAA, because almost all of them are warned, overtly or covertly, do not do what happened in Cork.
Especially because you say it's still a mystery why the money has, why it's over 30 million, the debt, and why it costs so much.
Yeah, there's never been a plausible explanation other than there was an overrun, really. And the frightening thing there, I think, because the GAA is facing large-scale renovation of a lot of venues, like a simple stadium, etc., Casement Park, which everyone will be familiar with, because that's such a looming headache for the GAA, finding all of that money, there's a lot of nervousness about when that money is committed, that it's spent properly, and that you don't have these overruns that have to be managed then for years afterwards.
You have very frank conversations with people. Was it hard to get people in the GAA to open up and talk?
Not as difficult as you might think. The likes of Tom Ryan in Croke Park, the Director General, Peter McKenna, these guys, I suppose they're used to putting their positions out and not defending, but kind of articulating where they're coming from. So it wasn't really a problem getting them to talk. It was very difficult to get people to talk about the cancer within the GAA, as someone said, of managers getting under the counter payments.
It was Christy Cooney, you quote. He
said that, and I think there was a bit of criticism at the time because I know we're all very sensitive about using that kind of terminology.
Yeah.
But in terms of something with the capacity or potential to really capsize the GAA, I think that is a huge issue, and it was difficult to get people to speak about that.
And he meant payment to managers, club, county level, both codes. It is rampant, but we have no evidence that it even happens.
It is an enormous shadow economy that is being run around the country with literally millions involved. And yet we blithely disregard this, even though it is staring us in the face.
You have really strong words on this. I want to actually read some of them because you're saying it's a widespread practice. And has been for a long time. And you're saying it's wrong, it's illegal for one thing, collecting cash by subterfuge without paying taxes against the law, which means those who do so are criminals and are making fools of the other members of the GAA who are paying their taxes. You reckon it's literally cash payments?
Yes, and it is probably the only place in Western Europe where cash remains king. The other great complication here is that you have units within the GAA who are paying managers illegally, and yet which are also enforcing the rules of the GAA.
Yes, okay,
so
yeah.
It really is an Alice in Wonderland situation where I won't say the lunatics have taken over the asylum, but the policemen are the people who are breaking the rules and breaking the laws. And what was really telling, nobody I spoke to questioned that for a fact, for an instant, that was a huge problem. Everybody accepted it. Yes, this is a problem. No one had a real solution to it. I know Jonathan Burns has advocated possibly having a stipend for managers to kind of formalise it. I would think that any time you were legislating to legitimise something that's illegal, that you're in trouble, and that would open another huge issue, which is employment law within the GAA.
Right. And then you have to pay them off if you're cancelling contracts early and so on. And there's a whole backroom team that comes with the one person.
Oh yeah, like if you're appointed manager of the Monaghan Footballers, great hoo-ha and fanfare, but then you lose a couple of games and the chairman says, I think we'll have to get rid of him.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to get a payoff? What if another county comes in and says, you're doing such a great deal with Monaghan here, we'll offer you more to take over our county.
Then terminate your own contract.
Yeah, and you can't have restraint of trade. As you say, this whole shadow economy of people who are not even the manager, but who are in the background. I know people who are providing a professional service like medics and physios are entitled to be compensated. But there are other people who are being paid very, very well, and there's no sign of that.
But as you point out in the book, it's the soul of the GAA that's being kind of destroyed, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you have examples of clubs that have refused to bring in the outside managers because they feel that's a failure of the club.
Yeah. Daryl Kaneda, who's, you know, an unbelievably articulate guy when it comes to, you know, putting a shape on, I won't say the soul of the GAA, but what the GAA's real motivation should be, said he'd have to walk away from his club if they brought in an outside manager. It would contravene everything that he sees their club as being for.
That was really dramatic, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that can sound a bit dramatic, you know, the soul of the GAA. But you have to ask the question, if the GAA isn't about money, which it isn't, supposedly, it's a community and voluntary organisation, then surely the soul of the GAA is the thing that counts. And as soon as you start cutting away at that bit by bit, then you're in real trouble because there is no justification if you're not doing it for the love of the game.
It kind of, that's the juiciest part of it, I think, all the money bit of it. Mm. But it also kind of highlights the kind of decentralisation of the GAA, isn't it? The power in county boards.
Yeah.
Because, and particularly, that comes to light around the PR and marketing of the organisation, relationship with the media, which you say is really terrible.
Yeah. Well, obviously, for many years, I had a dog in this fight. But you would have to say it is an embarrassment the way the GAA deals in terms of marketing its greatest asset, which is the players. With all due respect to administrators and referees and coaches and managers, people want to see the players. Mm-hmm. They are the people in every sport that the kids go out and emulate in the back garden. And I want to go down to the club and I want to imitate David Clifford and Patrick Horgan and all these guys. But, and here's the killer, you don't see those guys because the managers don't want them saying anything out of the ordinary or untoward that could be put up on the dressing room wall. OK, and that's fine. But if you look at professional sports, which the GAA often, you know, claims it models, those sports are putting up the people who are in the news. If a 19-year-old were to make his rugby debut for Ireland, unlikely, he would be the first person who's put out to speak to the press.
Yeah.
He's the big story. And all the kids say, look at him. He's 19. I want to be like him. What the kids are not saying is, well, I would really like to be like Oliver Callan there at Monaghan, but he's only 20 and he's not being put up. So I understand that the manager doesn't want him out in the public eye, so I won't be imitating him.
You can't
put an asterisk on young, talented hurlers and footballers and saying, sorry, kids, you're not going to hear from this guy or see this guy for about 10 years until we think he's ready. And you're missing out on huge opportunities. And that's not even to get into, you know, the atrocious state of GAA/media relations generally.
Because when we go to watch the Six Nations, you've players out all the time in the run-up. Yeah. And they say very interesting things. I remember Caelan Doris was talking about the bad atmosphere in Lansdowne Road.
Yeah.
And he's a young guy. He was saying, you need to get more pints into the students. And it was, you know, it wasn't not everyone agreed with it, but he was free to say it.
Yeah, and that,
you'd never hear a GAA player say
that drives
like
discussion and people. And as you say, I agree, I don't agree, but you're talking about the game. That is not, by the way, in any way a knock on rugby, because they are marketing the sports. No, the GAA has to market its sports, and that's probably uncomfortable to a coterie of people in the GAA, but I think most people recognise that if you want people to follow the games and enjoy the games and support the games have to be marketed by the people who are best at them, and that is the players. And unless there's some kind of accommodation there, that's not going to get better.
Yeah, you kind of want to see that. And then again, that's the, because the GAA headquarters, Croke Park, seems to be kind of a slick PR operation. Is it a kind of county board level that's suppressing the media relations?
It is. This is the unfortunate downside of democracy, of course, that county boards can actually make up their own minds. Now, in fairness to Croke Park and Gerald Burns have said, look, we'll have to, you know, accommodate, say, all our semi-finals, get the teams to put out players to kind of generate a bit of interest, etc. I hate to go back to the tyrannical county manager, but a lot of that relates back to control freaks who do not trust their
players. The
vanished
door, yeah. And they've dropped players for speaking out.
Oh yeah, and the big contradiction, of course, is that I'm the manager and I'm saying to you, I want you to make a decision in a heartbeat in front of 80,000 people with 14 other guys chasing around you, but I don't trust you to roll out a few cliches the weekend of the match. That's too much. You're not capable of that. You're capable of getting 3 goals in the All-Ireland final, but I don't trust you, a well-educated young man with views and opinions in the world, to actually articulate any of those in public.
Because it would be interesting to hear the players, for example, talk about the money in the GAA, because they're not getting paid. They're getting expenses for mileage at certain levels.
Yeah.
But they're generally putting their bodies on the line for free.
And the obvious conflict would be you have a dressing room where one person may be getting paid a lot of money and a lot of other guys are not being paid and are in fact putting their careers on hold, maybe putting overtime off because they have to train on a Saturday or go away for a weekend training camp. So there's an inherent conflict there that can't be fueled perpetually, to me, by the prospect of a medal. And I think when you have that conflict, that will break into open warfare at some point, whether it's with one particular player who gets the hump over something or on a more organised basis.
By the way, one of the little kind of fictional scenarios you pose in the book is a trainer. So he's kind of like third tier from the manager, is getting 300 quid a night for the training session, taking home 1,200 in cash a week. Is that based on research you've done?
Let us not encourage our learned friends in the four courts to take more of an interest in this conversation. It is certainly based.
They'll switch career.
It's based on an amalgamation of a couple of true stories in which, in this particular case, a much sought after coach was training a team in County X. He was approached by people in County Y who said, we'd like you to come and train our team, and he said, I'm happy to do that, but you'll have to facilitate my prior commitment. So he was out 4 or 5 nights a week.
They could train two different players.
On different alternative nights so he could collect his money.
And it's not all year round, it's seasonal, but it's extraordinary money.
But this is the point. The figures that are bandied around, it's not 50 quid a night. This is a lot of money. And you'd have to say, you know, this can't continue. I mean, the traditional one is, I think inter-county teams had official expenses last year, €43 million across the board. No, that can't be sustained indefinitely.
Yeah.
But there's a vast parallel economy that is being sustained as well. And you'd have to say, look, this can't carry on.
It's about the future.
Yeah.
Will players be eventually paid?
I can't see that for the simple reason I don't know if the economy could sustain it. And when I wrote G-Economics a few years ago, which is in a similar vein, I wrote at that time, how could you pay GAA players in a country where banks were literally failing? And we have to accept as well, despite what people say, the country is awash with something like kind of ready cash. So if there was a slight shake in the economy, where what happens then? I'm not sure if you could sustain paying players. And what is happening, and Tom Parsons, the GPA, was very good on this in the book. He was saying, creating an environment in which players are not out of pocket and who are at least, you know, aided in pursuing excellence in the GAA would be welcome. He did make the point, which is a very fair point. If you're an intercounty hurler footballer and a student, say, you can't work in Dunn's or in a pub on a Friday or Saturday night.
Yes, yeah.
So
at a time of rental crisis.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. And this, and as you mentioned that was another thing that impinged more on the book that I thought, the housing accommodation rental crisis, because a lot of the people I spoke to said, you know, a lot of GAA clubs, say in Dublin, would need space for pitches, etc. But more than one of them said, not sure how you could approach a local authority for a couple of fields when people are sleeping, when are homeless and sleeping in cars as well.
There's a great chapter in here about the terrible GAA rhetoric. The cliches, yeah, that drive you mad.
Yeah, I know that's kind of shooting fish in a barrel, as we're onto cliches. I mean, I wouldn't get up on my high horse and say, oh, we need to kind of remake the English language every time we cover, you know, the Glen and Sarahs in the Cork County Championship. But there is an issue with the lazy cliche, in the sense you're not discussing something properly. Here's a classic example. You're watching a hurling match, some guy gets a belt across the head, and the commentary is, well, he's not really that kind of player. He didn't mean that, so that shouldn't be a red card.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have to say, as someone who has been struck across the head by a 3-foot length of timber, it doesn't really matter if it's intentional or not. But on a serious note, you know, if you're serious about head injuries and ruling that out and making sure players aren't seriously hurt, there has to be a zero tolerance of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to get to the sense. You don't have to say, yes, he obviously meant to try and concuss his opponent, but you have to say, I think the way to articulate that is, okay, he may not have meant that, but that's a serious blow. That player could be injured. And for the benefit of everyone going forward, he needs to get a red card to show everybody that you have to stay away from people's heads.
And that leniency is sort of sometimes given because, oh, well, the attack wasn't intrinsic to his normal character.
Yeah,
every other day.
Even though the obvious evidence, he has just done it. So it is part of his character. But, you know, but I think there can be among the commentariat a sense that, well, I don't want to blacken this guy's name forever by saying, you know, in a split second, he did something wrong that he obviously didn't premeditate and he's probably regretful about. But you can go to the other extreme and just say, look, give him a pass, even though the person he struck is pouring with blood and possibly concussed. I think a small bit of exactitude in language is needed. But
you're a writer, you see. You can't bear the lazy, hackneyed slogans.
Well, if I never heard these lads have to get up for work in the morning again, I think we'd all be happy to retire that one.
Be very disappointed with himself.
Yeah, that's not in his nature. He's not that kind of player.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting as well, since it's all about the future, the GAA, and perhaps a political role in discussing a united Ireland.
Yeah, and it was interesting that people are happy to talk about that, because it's obviously, to say the least, a fraught subject. But I think it was Jack Anderson made the point that people forget that the GAA is a 32-county organisation, that a lot of sports organisations are.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are obviously, to be euphemistic, local challenges there. But, you know, the GAA reflects the society it's in every way, shape or form. And if there is a growing move towards a united Ireland, I think the GAA, it could be a useful ally in that. And certainly, when and if that happens, I think it would be well positioned, not to take advantage of, but to show off the benefits of an all-island approach to sport.
And the GAA, especially since the GAA is having such a cultural moment at the minute, King Fisher, most streamed song in Ireland this year, which is the GAA song about Killa.
Yes.
Not a fan?
No, it's
your
not.
Your head is going down.
No, it's not that. It's not that. I have two teenage girls. We were at Father John Misty a couple of weeks ago. They're going to the last dinner party. It's all very on point. But my wife's from Waterford, and when we go to Waterford, they insist on playing Killa when we go through Killa. So it's all very meta. They're singing about the River Desor, and they're saying, look, there is the River Desor.
The woods of Glen. You should have stopped and gone for the walk.
All the way.
But a lovely walk.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. I have to say, I wouldn't claim to be a music maven, but the way it was used by RTÉ for the football final. You're saying this really has taken really over
because they're singing it in Galway. A bit of Cork hurling team.
And it's a great catchy.
And then you had the two Johnnies at Liam McCarthy Cup of the Electric Picnic. There was a great GAA novel we covered here with John Patrick McHugh. A Galway man and set in Mayo. The ploughing, I always see the biggest queue is the O'Neill's tent.
Yeah.
Even though the kids queuing are head to toe in O'Neill's already. There's something very powerful going on that they really need to grasp, don't they, culturally in the country.
I remember years ago being on the book show on Radio 1 with Sinead Gleeson, and I was talking about in America, for instance, baseball is very much embedded in popular culture. Like, you know, serious novelists have serious opinions about baseball. And I was kind of thinking, why doesn't that happen here? But that has happened here kind of organically. And the other obvious example, someone like Sally Rooney's books.
Exactly.
To you and I, it would make eminent sense that someone from Mayo would write about Gaelic football, but I'm quite sure they're, you know, MA students in Stanford kind of puzzling out the symbolism.
I love how she didn't bother describing it. It's up to them to find out.
Yeah, exactly.
And they did.
Yeah, and it's entirely natural because it's entirely it is a huge part of Irish life in the widest sense. And I suppose it's good to see that, you know, your interest in the GAA isn't some kind of freakish anthropological outlier. Yeah.
It's called More Than a Game, and Pat Spillane describes it on the front as a book to start 1,000 debates. He's not wrong, and the texts were a testament to that. Hopefully we'll come to some of them before the end of the programme. But Michael Moynihan, thanks a million, and sure, keep positive and hopeful.
Absolutely, Oliver. Keep the good side out.
A trainer earning cash yourself before it's over. Back after these. Jumping back to that debate on the GAA and the payments and the money going around, Nick says rugby was previously in a similar situation to the GAA where shamateurism was everywhere. It wasn't sustainable. The only solution is to bring payments into the open and legitimise some level of professionalism. Now, that's worked out very well in Ireland, of course, but it hasn't. Rugby professionalism hasn't worked out in places like Wales, of course, as they'll know. Mark is in Adelaide in Australia. He says, look to the dangers of a grassroots organisation becoming a business over here or down here in Australia. The AFL is driven, that's the Aussie rules, driven by money and TV rights with a huge disconnect with grassroots. A warning there from where the GAA is going.